From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the California State Legislature concluded its present session Tuesday without a state budget, which was due 2 months ago. We'll discuss the ongoing struggle to get a state budget in place, and we'll find out what significant legislation was passed and defeated. We'll also get some reaction and analysis to the debate between Senate candidate incumbent Barbara Boxer and Carly Fiorina. The state budget crisis, the state's legislative session, and state politics. Forum is next with your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. California, with an ongoing $19 billion shortfall, is now over 2 months into the present fiscal year without a budget. As Governor Schwarzenegger noted in a speech he delivered in San Francisco on Tuesday, the present stalemate between the Republicans looking for major cuts and the Democrats looking for tax revenues, as well as the governor's own demands for budget and pension reform, is costing the state some $56 million a day, with little glimmer of a solution in sight. The legislature concluded its present session on Tuesday, and we want to discuss in this forum hour what came out of it, or in the case of a solution to the budget crisis, what didn't. But first, we want to check in with KQED's Scott Schaefer, who served last night as one of the three journalists questioning the state's two Senate candidates, incumbent Senator Barbara Boxer and former Hewlett-Packard executive Carly Fiorina. And Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, it was a slugfest, and by most lights, at least. I suppose if you're looking for what to judge it on in these pugilistic matches, Boxer came out ahead.
Well, yeah, I think she won by not losing. I think Fiorina is perhaps the better debater, but Boxer gave as good as she got. And I think coming out of the debate, there are a number of things that the Boxer campaign can follow up on in terms of positions that Fiorina took. You know, typically in elections, you run to the left if you're a Democrat in the primary and then come to the middle during the general. And if you're a Republican, you run to the right in the primary and come to the middle. That's what Meg Whitman is doing more or less. Carly Fiorina is not really doing that. And she last night reiterated some of her more conservative positions on things like abortion, gun control, climate change, and the environment. And it'll be interesting to see if that how that goes over with voters in California.
Well, this is, of course, supposed to be a blue state. And when I was listening to Carly Fiorina take these positions, I kept thinking, is this a Tea Party state suddenly? Are we, much more conservative in her mind with her Sarah Palin backing and all of that than maybe she is perhaps under that kind of impression?
Well, it's a terrible time to be running as an incumbent, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And I think that she's running as an outsider or trying to, Carly Fiorina. She's never run for office before. And she is sticking true to those positions that really motivate her base. And, you know, one of the issues for the Democrats in November is how enthused their base is. Right now, they're demoralized and a little bit depressed. And so I think perhaps Fiorina is thinking if she can keep her base energized, that the turnout in November will be more conservative and that'll accrue to her advantage.
She kept trying to say, you're a career politician, a Boxer, and Boxer kept trying to say, well, you know, you were outsourcing jobs and jobs were lost under your reign at Hewlett-Packard. It seemed to me that they were trying to paint each other into a corner in those respects and probably managed to certainly get their message across in both instances.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a record that Carly Fiorina has at Hewlett-Packard. She was dismissed by the board of directors. A lot of people at the company do not like her, did not like her when she was there. They didn't like her style. They didn't like how she ran the company. And so Boxer, we're going to hear more about that and the fact that a lot of jobs were outsourced and what that says about her, how she views working people and the future of manufacturing in this country. And Boxer is a career politician. She doesn't shy away from that. She couldn't if she wanted to. But it's really going to, I think, come down to whether voters who are in a very bad mood this year feel that Barbara Boxer is part of the problem or could be part of the solution. And I think that's sort of what the campaign is going to be about.
Voters don't like Barbara Boxer. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. Tom Campbell probably would have done much better against her, I think.
Well, that was the conventional wisdom. It was funny because Barbara Boxer brought up Tom Campbell last night, referring to his exasperation over Fiorina's position on whether or not you should be able to have a gun if you're on the no-fly list. But no, I think that was the conventional wisdom. But, you know, Fiorina is a not to be underestimated, and I don't think the Boxer campaign is underestimating her. She's very articulate. She's smart. She looks good on TV, and she is formidable.
At least nothing was said about hair. But both said that it was a clear choice, and indeed it is a clear choice.
It is a very clear choice, and the voters will have to make it come November.
At all frustrating for you? I mean, you had to sit there and throw out questions and you couldn't follow up?
Yeah, you know, we're all bound by these rules that the candidates agree to. And three of us, Carla Marinucci and Pilar Marrero and I, were not allowed to ask any follow-ups. Randy Shandabel did a nice job as the moderator of asking follow-ups where he could. But yeah, you have to just, you know, they're not really answering your question, but there's really nothing you can do about it.
I thought Randy was very good also as a timekeeper. He was aggressive, and you have to be, because they both would have filibustered had they been.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a tough job, but he did a good job.
Well, same with you, and congratulations, and good to have you here to get this eyewitness view from you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Scott Schaefer. We're going to talk politics some more, but we're also going to talk about the budget and what's going on in California with respect to the current session that ended just on Tuesday. Dan Walters is with us, veteran political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, and we welcome him to the program. Good to have you here. Good morning.
Thank you.
And Professor Barbara O'Connor joining us as well, Emeritus Professor of Communications with the Institute for the Study of Politics and Media at Cal State Sacramento. And good morning, Barbara O'Connor. Do we have Barbara O'Connor?
Yeah, I'm on.
Okay.
Okay, I'm on. Sorry. Good morning,
okay.
Michael and Dan. How are you?
Good morning to you. Well, Barbara, let me get your take on last night on the debate, impressions and thoughts from you.
Well, it was interesting to have two women. And I think, you know, the women that I know were watching to see if it was any different because they were women. It wasn't, actually. And I agree with much of what Scott said. I think probably technically Barbara would be listed as the winner if you knew enough facts to know that. But Carly certainly was formidable, and I agree with you. I think the issues that she is hanging to are ones that typically don't resonate with most of California voters.
So how much does that debate really weigh in with California voters, or how much do you see it making an impact? It's still fairly early, and as far as November, what do you think?
Well, it's the only one they've agreed to have. So, you know, reporters will be quoting it widely, and so will the campaigns, and so will YouTube and various other places. I don't think people were glued to their television sets last night, and often it's secondary reporting on a debate that helps frame what the real outcome was. I'm surprised that they're not going to do more, but, you know, the Boxer camp has said that's it. And we'll see a lot of 30-second ads. And I think people are tired of 30-second ads, largely because there have been so many from the Whitman campaign. And after Labor Day, conventionally, is when they start to focus and frame their feeling about folks and how they're going to vote. So who knows?
Who knows? Dan Walter, what was your takeaway?
I thought it was actually pretty even up until the closing statements, and Senator Boxer kind of got the best of it there. She came across more forcefully. Fiorina went flat kind of in that last thing. And so I think Barbara Boxer probably, you know, won by a nose on that basis alone. But I think it's an interesting thing. First of all, this election doesn't really hinge as much on Fiorina as it does on Boxer. I mean, she's not popular with voters. Her disapproval ratings are higher than her approval ratings. In the past, she's been able to overcome that by facing candidates that were poorly financed, male candidates who'd never had much pizzazz, basically. But this is a different dynamic. I mean, some of her opponents in the past have been kind of reluctant to really go out and out attack on her. I mean, she's always played that game. It's kind of playing the gender card to a certain extent because she is a woman. She's always depicted herself as being under siege, this poor, defenseless woman under siege by all these forces of evil. That's kind of the way that's her constant campaign theme. But having a woman opponent means that she can be attacked. The woman can attack her without looking like a bully. And so that creates a different kind of dynamic. And sure, Carly Fiorina's positions on abortion and some of these others are turnoffs to voters, a lot of voters, particularly those middle-of-the-road voters. But the question is whether anger at incumbent politicians, a kind of throw-the-bums-out mood, will overcome that among those independent middle-of-the-road voters who will decide any close election in California.
Yeah, that's the big question. But as you pointed out in one of your articles, I think you were quoting Roll Call Stuart Rothenberg, that the fate of the Obama presidency and a lot of Senate control, I mean, there are big stakes in this race.
Yeah, they are. In fact, it's just an article in Politico just today saying the same thing, that the Republican hopes of controlling the Senate hinge on three races, one in Wisconsin with Russ Feingold, one in Washington State, and California. So, in a sense, California is the final seat. And because that's true, another thing comes into play this year that's never come into play with Barbara Boxer before. That is that Carly Fiorina will get national money. She'll get money from the National Chamber of Commerce and Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. Republican candidates for the Senate in California have never gotten that kind of money simply because it's so expensive to campaign in California, it wasn't worth it because they could put their money in other states. But if California is the final nail, as it were, then and Carly Fiorina is viable, which she certainly appears to be, then you'll see this election somewhat nationalized, which it has never been in the past. So there, this is wholesale. In fact, the latest poll, really, from Rasmussen shows Boxer losing by quite a substantial amount. So this seat is definitely in play.
Dan Walters with us from Sacramento, is political columnist with the Sacramento Bee. And Dan, let me shift gears here and get your thoughts about the budget. There doesn't seem to be much of an urgency to find a compromise. In fact, no special session. And 2 years ago, we went to a record of September 16th. And again, we're talking about IOUs. This could go on until after the election, couldn't it?
It could very easily go on after the election, and one reason is the election itself. The fact that this is an election year, the fact that the governor's a lame duck, all plays into this. The fact that there's Proposition 25 on the ballot that would lower the voting requirement for a budget from two-thirds to a simple majority is in play. Not for two reasons. Number one, if it passes, it changes the whole dynamic of the thing.
I think it hurt Fiorina that she didn't take a position on 25, don't you think?
No, she didn't take a position on 23.
I mean, on 23, excuse me, right.
Yeah, but 25 is the measure that lowers the vote requirement to simple majority. That's in play for two reasons. Number one, it could change the dynamics if it passes. Number two, the longer this budget stalemate goes into effect, the angrier voters become. And one section of Proposition 25, a kind of a duplicitous section in a sense, punishes the legislature when the budget is late. So you could see a campaign in the last month going on and on about punish the legislature, vote for Proposition 25, punish the legislature, vote for Proposition 25, even though it's the dominant Democrats in the legislature and their allies who are sponsoring Proposition 25. So the fact that it's an election year plays into this, and this thing could easily go into November. It could easily go until the next governor's in place. And in fact, it may go until at least they know who the next governor is, because that changes the dynamic of the thing.
Barbara O'Connor, see it pretty much the same way?
Yeah, I actually do. I think Dan's right on. The only thing I want to go back to is sort of who's going to decide the Senate debate. I agree with everything about outside money coming in, but I actually think women will decide what goes on in California. And that does not bode as well for Carly, given her stand on issues. If you look at women historically and you even look at the crosstabs on the Rasmussen poll, they haven't made up their mind. And so it will be both personality and issue-centric, I think, that drive women of both parties to vote, and certainly the independent women. But on the budget, I mean, I don't envy John Chung. I'm talking to him about it. I think as the IOUs roll out and more layoffs come and furlough Fridays are back, that you're going to have an angry group of people for all incumbents. Dan's absolutely right. And this election, I think, is hard to predict for that reason, because the issues would argue that it would go more Democratic, but the mood of the populace is still, why aren't they talking about things I care about? Every poll says that. And this year we're at a biological drive level with voters. I mean, it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where they're saying the only thing I care about is the quality of my life and my children's life. And so the federal issues on Social Security and the debt commission also come into play in both of these races. And it's going to be very, very difficult to predict how people are going to behave.
It's also difficult to predict what they may do in November here in California, because there's a lot of anger also at this legislature.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And let's talk a bit about that. That is what went through and what didn't go through the legislature in this last session. Certainly a lot of talk has been focused on what was voted down. The plastic band bag, for example, AB 1998 voted down in the Senate, and other things that were voted down, like Joe Simidian's bill in the Senate, 722, that have required utilities to set 33% power for renewables. And it seems like things are even more ideologically frozen, not only with respect to the budget, but with respect to a lot of the legislation that didn't go through.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, in many ways, I was looking at the bills going, well, we're less of a nanny state this year. You know, the plastic, if you want to view it that way, some of the legislation that would more micromanage things did not go through. And in the overall tally, you know, probably the chamber had a very good day, and large corporate interests had a very good day. And given that the Democrats still have, despite the two illnesses, enough votes to pull most things off, they didn't. So it's a chamber that's disorganized, and I think the members of it are not looking forward to going back to their districts and explaining their behavior, which is what they're now doing.
On the other hand, Dan Walters, the defeat of the so-called Walmart bill and Jim Beal's bill, which extends foster care maximum age, and Jared Huffman having ships now required to have a boom when they transfer oil, all of these things, and Leno's bill, Mark Leno's bill on health insurers giving consumers essentially a 60-day notice before increasing pensions. These all seem to suggest, again, more progressive politics succeeding in the legislature.
Well, yes and no. It's, the legislature is a liberal legislature. Let's just be clear about that. But a lot of the liberal shibboleths died this week. In part, there was weak leadership. The place has become more chaotic. Leadership is weaker. But you cannot overstate the effect of having two liberal state senators out on illness and not being available to vote. The Democrats have 25 votes in the Senate. That dropped them to 23, and they need 21 through it. It meant a handful of moderate, business-friendly Democrats controlled the House all during the week. It's very frustrating to the liberal groups and liberal legislators. These people controlled the House. So, yes, for example, Mark Leno's bill on insurance notifications and passed, but the more important bill that would have actually subjected insurance rates to direct regulation by the insurance commissioner, sponsored by the Democratic candidate for insurance commissioner, Dave Jones, died.
Right.
And so yes, but the real liberal bills, the ones that the liberal advocacy groups and whatnot really counted on, they didn't make it. Plastic bags, chemicals, I mean, they just didn't make it. And part of it was leadership. Part of it was kind of worrying about the voters a little bit. But a lot of it was the fact that you lost two liberal votes in the Senate. A lot of bills lost by just one vote in the Senate.
What about, for example, Barbara O'Connor, in light of what Dan's saying, AB 1934, which we talked about here on Forum, the banning of open carrying of unloaded weapons? How do you read that?
Well, that's another one. I mean, you know, you sit there going, okay, normally you could predict this bill. But you couldn't, for the very reasons that Dan isolates. I mean, watching it up close late at night, the level and tenor of the discussion was really pugnacious, even among fellow caucus members. The acrimony level's really high. There is no consensus on a unified plan, and moderate Dems really did dominate the day.
And how do you see things projected at this point, Dan Walters? I think in one of your columns you said it's almost impossible to say how this is going to go in November.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I want to say something else about the legislative session. I mean, take that gun bill, for example. That gun bill actually made it through the Senate. All they needed was one more concurrence vote over in the Assembly, which had voted for it already. But as what the Democratic leadership of the legislature wasted 3 hours on the final day on a meaningless budget debate.
Right.
So when the clock started ticking towards midnight, suddenly the Republicans could filibuster bills. And that gun bill got back over to the Assembly. The Republicans said, basically, we'll filibuster this until midnight. And the Democratic leadership threw that bill over to save several other bills, because by then, when you got close to midnight, then the Republicans actually had power, the power of the clock. And that bill got thrown over by the Democratic leadership to save several other bills.
No, and Dan's right, Michael. I mean, normally we have sort of all willingly gone along with midnight not being midnight. That didn't happen this year. Midnight was midnight. And, you know, lots of people threatened to sue. The acrimony level is what I was talking about. Even members of their own party were threatening to challenge bills that came after midnight.
Well, it's without a budget now, things are looking pretty bleak. Although, Dan Walters, I noticed you are figuring, again, we're prognosticating a little bit here, but maybe there will be some short-term gimmicks and accounting tricks and maybe those sorts of things that we've seen in the past to get past this budget impasse. But at the same time, in fact, another column of yours, I think you said that we can't seem to balance the budget in the state. We have an abysmal credit rating, severe traffic congestion, potholed roads, global laughing stock, doomed to failure, and yet optimistic about revenue projections?
No, I'm not optimistic about revenue projections at all. This budget situation is very typical of this what I call the crisis of governance in California. We cannot get our stuff together. I almost used another word. And it's very emblematic of this continuing crisis of governance, just a chronic inability to deal with what's there on the plate, mismanagement, polarization, gerrymandered districts, term limits, ballot measures. I mean, we have put ourselves into this ungovernable mess, and nobody weighs out. If the budget comes out, the later it goes, the more likely it is to just be another bunch of get-out-of-town gimmicks, yeah. Creative bookkeeping, Enron-like tricks, counting phantom revenues, that sort of thing. And then the next governor, whoever he or she is unlucky enough to be, will find that big, heaping, stinking mess on their desk the day they walk in the door. And that's the most likely scenario, is that sometime in the next few months they'll do some sort of a crappy budget that won't hang together more than, you know, 50, 60 days or something like that, and then the whole thing will roll over into the next governor.
But would you agree, Barbara O'Connor, with Dan, that Proposition 25 could be a whole game changer?
Yeah, I'm more optimistic than Dan. We've talked about these issues before. I think there are things in place that will make it different, and I agree they won't happen this year. And so not only Prop 25, but I also think, you know, the redistricting commission could, in fact, be a game changer on six or seven districts. The open primary is going to be a game changer. So, you know, I think longer term, we're going to be a little better off. But it doesn't solve the problem now. Dan's absolutely right. And the governor, you know, is saying, I'm not going to sign this mess. And John Chung is saying, I can't bond with this mess. Everybody's wise to your games. So I'm even a little bit more optimistic that we may have an interim solution that's marginally better.
Well, let me open our phone lines and invite you, our listeners, to weigh in here. We're talking about not only the budget and the frustration of that ongoing stalemate in Sacramento, but also some of the legislation that came out or didn't come out of the session that ended at, as Barbara O'Connor said, actually ended at the clocks towering over everybody and telling them they had to end. And talking about California politics, you may have some responses to the debate if you saw it last night, or the ongoing sense of where we're going in November or where we're going to go afterward. Talking about the state, really, and your calls are welcome. Toll free, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the debate last night between Carly Fiorina, former head of Hewlett-Packard, and Senate incumbent Barbara Boxer, and also talking about California politics, as well as what came out of the last legislative session and the budget, which continues to be at a stalemate. With us, Barbara O'Connor, who's Emeritus Professor of Communication with the Institute for the Study of Politics and Media at Cal State University, Sacramento, communications professor there for many years, and Dan Walters, veteran political columnist with the Sacramento Bee. I want to go to your calls and emails, but first, I want to get some clarification. Michael Endicott, a resource sustainability advocate with the Sierra Club, sent us a note saying that AB 722 was not actually voted down. It passed the Assembly. The Senate did not get to it before the midnight clock struck. I believe that's accurate, but if we want to sort of deconstruct it a bit, Dan Walters, the oil and chemical industry lobbies kind of held things up there. I mean, it was, as you sort of alluded to, their victory in a way, wasn't it?
Listen, that was another one of those things. That thing sat over in the Assembly for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and they were trying to rewrite it, and all the interest groups were behind closed doors trying to rewrite that thing, and they could never basically come to an agreement. So a bill, a version of it, was thrown out on the Assembly floor about 11:30 on the last night, got over to the Senate a few minutes before midnight. And it was just, one of those things that just they just ran out of time on, and they spent 3 hours with a meaningless debate over budgets that had no effect whatsoever. It was just a show, or what they call in the Capitol, a drill. And they never even started doing the day's business until late in the afternoon. And then they ran out of time at midnight. I mean, that's just poor management.
Boy, do I hear the exasperation of having observed that in your voice.
But, well, it's just. We should be ashamed of having a bunch of incompetent nincompoops running the California legislature, I would think.
Well, Barbara O'Connor, that bill, again, Joe Simidian actually wrote it would require utilities to set 33% power.
Right, no, I know.
I'm just reiterating for the sake of listeners, 33% of power for renewables. But the Union of Concerned Scientists has called on the governor to actually call a special session on it, and he seems in favor of it, so that may happen.
Yeah, you know, he really does believe in his legacy item of in sort of embracing the planet and making it better. And that's part of that whole issue. I mean, but Dan's absolutely correct. I mean, they putzed around on it. I know people who were in the conversations and couldn't get agreement. And then he's right about the fact they spent 3 hours on the budget. It should have been one of the bills that went through. It might not have with the two votes missing. The Republicans might have stalled it. But your caller is absolutely correct. It was ready to tee up, and it never happened.
Why do you suppose there isn't more outrage at the kind of thing that Dan Walters has observed for us, Barbara O'Connor? I mean, why aren't California citizens up in, well, not necessarily up in arms, but up in kind of populist revolt or something along those lines when we talk about this failure of the legislature and the governor to not only reach two-thirds on the budget, but just to really move through a piece of legislation of this sort?
Well, they're frustrated and they're disgusted. I mean, every poll that you look at has the lowest approval ratings in history. We do have demonstrations up here by various interest groups in Sacramento. Every time we go to the Capitol, there's somebody closing down L Street. So I think they are acting as they know how to act. But more importantly, I think they think all government is failing them. And that is the desperation. When we talked earlier, I said they're really at a biological needs level. They're at a Maslow level of just wanting their lives to be better. And that kind of rabid frustration, which is out there everywhere, every focus group I sit in on, will come to bear fruit at some point. It hasn't yet. I mean, they're doing what they can, but they don't perceive themselves as having much power over it.
And again, Barbara O'Connor is Emeritus Professor of Communications at Cal State Sacramento and with the Institute for the Study of Politics and Media. And your calls. We begin with Matthew. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. Longtime listener. Really enjoy the program.
Thank you.
Wanted to just ask your guest to comment on the role of term limits and how that affects the leadership in both houses of the legislature. My personal feeling is that with the term limits, you constantly have members moving from one house to another trying to find places to be, and it really affects the leadership and the role of the leadership in moving legislation through.
Well, Dan Walters, when you were going through sort of the catalog of things that have obstructed movement in this state, you mentioned term limits.
Yeah, and that's a legitimate thing to mention, but you have to keep that in context. Term limits are in the context of very other things that have happened that have changed the political climate in California. The state itself has undergone tremendous sociological and demographic and economic change. You have gerrymandered districts. I personally believe that term limits under themselves didn't make much difference in the output of the legislature. It was dysfunctional before term limits and dysfunctional after term limits. it changed the culture, the internal culture of the place, but it didn't change the output. Then along came gerrymandered districts in the last decade, and they interacted with term limits to create rapid turnover in guaranteed districts. And that meant that interest groups could control the primary elections, which were the only elections that counted in the legislative arena. And that then created more polarization in the legislature and contributed to this kind of poisonous atmosphere in which nobody trusts anybody, nobody likes anybody, everybody's out to do in the guy next door. It's a poisonous, unproductive atmosphere. But it's not just because of term limits. It's because of a bunch of things that have happened. Just the fact that California has become this very complicated state, and on any issue, such as that utility issue or gun control or anything else, there are myriad interest groups that come to Sacramento to lobby. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, to reconcile all the competing demands of all the disparate interest groups in a complex state like this. So California is very difficult to govern, perhaps impossible, but it's not just because of term limits. That's just one of many contributing factors.
Speaking about how California is perhaps impossible to govern, let's just, before we go to more calls here, Barbara O'Connor, get your thoughts on the governor's race. Dan Walters, in one of his columns, was talking about just how it's kind of shape-shifting. The positions have shifted, and in fact, he alluded earlier to the fact that, as is typical in a politics of this sort, you have Meg Whitman, when she was campaigning against Posner, being pretty much conservative, now moving over toward the center, and you have Jerry Brown probably on the left moving more toward the center. But the problem for California voters is to decide who's going to move us out of this morass.
Right. And they don't trust any of them to do that. So the real problem is how many of them will vote in November. And, you know, just to wrap the term limits conversation, I agree with Dan totally. It's more than that. But part of what happens late in session is if you don't know each other or trust each other, or you're a freshman leading a whole house, you don't have the interpersonal relationships that you need to trust. And I think, you know, even extending them, which is what California Forward wanted to do, would make some difference at that level. You know, you talk to members one-on-one, and I think knowing each other better might help a little bit, but I am a professor of communications.
And we go on to more of your calls. Let's go to Burlingame. Phil, join us. Good morning.
Hi, I'm a Democrat, and I have to say that, you know, the problem as I see it is the Democrats in the state are playing a dangerous game, you know, not being able to pass budgets and achieve unity. And, you know, the only thing that's preserved Democrats in the state is Republicans in California tend to be of the more extreme variety that voters have rejected. So, you know, my question, that's part of the comment, but the question is, you know, when are they going to get a 55% rule, and when are the Democrats going to understand that they need to, you know, close ranks? Because if the state of California goes Republican, we're looking at the federal government being Republican for as long as the eye can see.
Feel free to jump in, Barbara or
well,
Dan.
I'll jump before Dan. I mean, I'm sure he's got some pithy comments on that. I don't disagree with the caller, but, you know, I've been here since 72, so we've seen these cycles of, you know, the prediction of you'll be Republican forever. I lived through Republican governors, Republican legislatures. Right now, we are in such complex times that it doesn't take too long before whoever is in power gains enough animus to get thrown out. So, yes, you're correct that it might happen for a while. But I really do go back to the, I think there are systemic changes afoot. And I would encourage the caller and others to support those changes that would, over time, I think, make it more governable. And I'm hopeful that those will go through, because not to be hopeful is pretty depressing.
Well, Dan Walters, you don't sound very hopeful this morning.
Well, I'm a professional grouch. But you have to remember that the things that Barbara mentions that might do independent redistricting, for example, that may not even be here.
Yeah.
Yes, we have it on right now. The commission to do the redistricting is being formed right now. But one measure on the ballot would abolish it and put it all back in the hands of the legislature. And that's got the backing, financial and otherwise backing, of the entire Democratic Party leadership of California.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it could easily be nothing. we could wind up exactly back where we are very, very quickly. I mean, this California's government definitely needs an overhaul. We need to have a government that's in tune with what we are in the 21st century, and we don't have that. We have our 19th century adaption of the 18th century model as modified multiple times in the 20th century, and it's totally out of step with what we are as a society. And the sooner we recognize that and the sooner we do something about it, the sooner we might have a chance of beginning to govern ourselves and stop being the laughingstock of the world.
Let me thank Phil for his call and move on to more of your calls. We go next to William. Good morning.
Hi. I want to just go back to the debate between Fiorina and Boxer for a second. I was pushed in the direction of being an independent. I've been a Democrat for 40 years. I was pushed in the direction of being independent because not only are the polls kind of even there, but a couple of issues for, among many that I dislike from those two. You know, one is they both, you know, Boxer voted for NAFTA, and Fiorina is in favor of NAFTA, I'm sure. And NAFTA certainly is one of the things that helped our jobs go overseas much quicker. And two, Boxer voted many, many times to fund this war. Not once did she not unfund this war. So I'm being pushed, partly as a result of this debate, toward being independent and voting so. Maybe from Green or Peace and Freedom. I'm not sure why, but I feel like I'm kind of pushed out of the Democratic Party in some way. I'm beyond the pale somehow.
Well, you know, your call prompts me, and thank you, William, to ask for some analysis from Dan Walters or Barbara O'Connor just about the role that independent voters are going to play in this upcoming election. It's running a dead heat now between the two gubernatorial candidates as far as the polls are concerned. And we keep hearing about the importance of Hispanic voters. We keep hearing about the importance of women voters, as Barbara O'Connor pointed out. But obviously independents are a key, aren't they, in many ways, Dan Walters?
Independents are absolutely the key. In any close election, statewide election in California, how goes the independents, so goes the electorate. They're about a little over 40% of the voters in California are registered Democrats. A little over 30% are registered Republicans. Neither party can get there with their own people.
Right.
They have to have the independents. The independents control the electorate. They're about 20% of the electorate, and they're the ones who basically ultimately decide who's in and who's out. But they're not an easily cataloged group. They tend to be somewhat conservative on law and order and tax matters, somewhat liberal on social matters. And so treading that, I mean, actually, Arnold Schwarzenegger fits those independents perfectly. Of course, he's very unpopular, too. So I don't know. But that's where you've got to be. And so with the more Barbara Boxer hits the paddles on the left, as it were, and the more Carly Fiorina paddles on the right, the less they're appealing to those middle-of-the-road voters, those independents, middle-of-the-road voters, who are basically will decide this election. So each one is trying to kind of flank the other, get around the other, try to find some theme that resonates with those decisive voters, that last 10 to 20% of the voters who will actually decide this election.
Barbara O'Connor.
And they don't historically vote as frequently. So, and they have different media use patterns. So Dan's absolutely correct, trying to figure out what's going to move them to vote and not vote green, as your caller said, is really a tough choice. I mean, if you look at how they use the media, this group of folks is less impressed by 30-second TV spots. So has Meg Whitman wasted her money on them with the $115 million she spent thus far on 30-second ads? Many people argue yes, that they're not watching them. They're using other media. They're using things that take them out of that realm. And I think this is a watershed election. You know, we won't know it till it's over. But I do think this group, and I've sat in on numbers of focus groups with independents, they're a different group of voters. And the real question is, will they vote? And or will they go to a third-party candidate, like your caller indicated he would? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. And anybody who says they do is lying.
Well, if you'd like to join us in the time remaining, by the way, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by simply going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Continue our conversation with Dan Walters, political columnist with the Sacramento Bee, and Barbara O'Connor, Emeritus Professor of Communications at Cal State Sacramento and with the Institute for the Study of Politics and Media there. And Craig is our next caller. Craig, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Good program. You know, you often hear the expression that California is the eighth largest economy in the world. But if political scientists were to analyze what the system is like, the combination, I think, the two pillars of minority rule, along with the fact that very few Democrats ever get elected governor, you know, it's a position that can be bought by wealthy candidates. I think we have the worst record over the last 100 years of any state in the country. If you combine those two things, you know, we have a near corporate dictatorship in terms of a system. And I think one of the problems is that we don't really have a democratic culture. I'm involved in the Democrats in San Leandro, but San Leandro has never had a Democratic Party organization. We have 25,000 registered Democrats, and we've never had an organization. And this is probably true for many, many cities in California. When the population exploded, we were this candidate-centered system, and it's also true for the Republicans. They don't really have local party organizations. And the other thing I would mention in terms of the Senate, most of the countries have a Senate based on population, and, you know, if you did the numbers, we have 300 million people. That means 100 senators. We'd have a senator for every 3 million people. California rightfully should probably have 12 senators, not 2 senators.
That's an interesting point. Not going to happen, but I don't know. Dan, do you think I think something the caller said initially in his first point resonates with me. I don't think either of these parties is all that well organized.
Well, you can thank Hiram Johnson for that. Hiram Johnson, the great reformist governor that was in California exactly a century ago, considered parties to be, quote, vessels of corruption. And many of the reforms that were adopted during the progressive era in the first part of the 20th century were aimed at reducing the power of parties. And in consequence of that, for example, we have nonpartisan local elections, so there are no local city machines like there are in Chicago and places like that. And so the parties are weak, relatively speaking, to those in other states, and so we tend to do the kind of the cult of the personality. Each individual candidate basically sets up his own apparatus or her own apparatus, and we see that in this year's election. Jerry Brown's going alone. Carly Fiorina's going alone. Meg Whitman's going it alone. I mean, these people, they do it on their own, and that's the legacy of Hiram Johnson in California. Would we be better off to have stronger parties? I don't know. That's a debate that goes on in academic circles all the time, the so-called strong party movement or the party reform movement and everything. But as a matter of fact, we don't have that, and so we have this kind of amorphous sort of thing. But the flip side is if we had these stronger party mechanisms that the caller talked about, maybe we didn't have machines and be complaining about being dictated to by political machines.
Either way, it's a tough position to be in if you're a Californian. John is our next caller. John, you want to set the record straight on Barbara Boxer's record here?
Yes. This concerns two of her votes. She voted against NAFTA. It was Dianne Feinstein who supported NAFTA, and Nancy Pelosi also supported NAFTA. Barbara Boxer, the Democrats in California were split on NAFTA. Some of them voted for it, some of them voted against it. Boxer,
actually, I'm looking at the votes right here, and you're right, Boxer did vote against NAFTA.
Yes, and she voted against CAFTA also.
But so did Feinstein, by the way.
I don't know about Feinstein.
I'm looking at the roll call right here, and she voted against it also.
NAFTA?
Yeah.
But not against CAFTA.
I don't know about CAFTA.
Yeah, that was in the 21st century vote.
Yeah.
Also, Barbara Boxer was one of 8 senators to vote against the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which, of course, led to the current debacle in the financial and banking industry. So those are 2 good votes that she's had.
All right. I thank you for that, John. We appreciate hearing from you. And we'll next hear from Michael, who's calling us from Brentwood. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question to the group is this, and it's kind of a challenging question. People have asserted during this conversation that California may be ungovernable. I don't believe this is true. I think that what you're seeing is what you see in history all the time, which is you have to have some calamitous event, whether it's California defaulting on its debt or something, that forces voters to make a choice. We're going to go with the Republicans or we're going to go with the Democrats, but we are going to go with somebody. And as an example of that, after the Bush administration, people were terrified of what was going to happen in the United States with the implosion of the banking industry. And what did you see? You saw Barack Obama get 60% of the electorate, which was unheard of. So I think that's what's got to happen. And if some of the people agree with me, I'd like to know what you think that calamitous event will be. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank
you. Thank you. The calamitous reactive view of history. Yeah. Barbara O'Connor. Yeah.
I agree with Michael totally. And, you know, I appreciate the caller correcting the record. That's what I said at the outset. It depends on how many facts you know who won the debate last night. But Michael's correct. And I actually think that we're getting there. And it may happen before November. It certainly will happen by next year, where the quality of life becomes so bad for individual citizens that the independents will align with a party. Now, which one is not predictable? And, Michael's correct. We do have historic cataclysms that push people to declare. And right now, they're all angry, and it's unfocused anger. Hopefully, before November, they'll get it together.
Well, Barbara, here's a listener, a physician from Sacramento, who says your guest Barbara O'Connor's statement that L Street is regularly closed by protesters is patently false. If you don't count street parties, closures this calendar year, one. The question can't be so easily brushed aside. Why so little public protest?
Well, that's not true. Yes, they closed L Street, but they picket the park all the time. They picket the front of the Capitol all the time. The L Street closing was a week and a half ago and created quite a traffic nightmare. I remember a couple of others, by the way, this year. So the question is, how do they feel about that action causing an effect? And the average person who doesn't live in Sacramento or isn't a member of an organized constituency doesn't really see themselves as coming up here and storming the Capitol effectively. And they're probably right. You know, looking at how staff handle constituents who walk in the door, you have to get an organized group to shut down the place. And that's tough to do when you're disengaged.
Dan Walters, whenever you talk about how ungovernable the state is, we get people who come in with solutions or ideas, or particularly when we're talking about the budget. I'm just going to give you a little sample, a couple samples here. David in Berkeley writes, isn't there a legal option to physically lock all the California legislators and the governor in the Capitol building and not open the door until there's a budget? Or we have Julie, who says maybe the solution should be to have legislators' paychecks dependent on finishing their job in a timely manner. Can you imagine if you or I missed deadlines repeatedly? Since the downturn, I no longer have long-term contracts. Everything is week to week and month to month. I certainly would like their job security. No wonder many citizens feel politically apathetic. Outrage? Yes, I'm outraged. And here's another listener named Michael who says, what would the pros and cons be if the state were to file for bankruptcy? Would a judge's orders on these matters be a better solution to sort out the fiscal mess than leaving it up to the politicians who have proved to be ineffective in solving the current and long-term budget impasses? What is in the state's and taxpayers' best interest going forward, and what are the wider implications of long-term unfunded obligations? And so it goes. I mean, those kinds of antidotes, if you will. Yeah, Van Walters.
Let me say something about the caller who said, well, you know, people like, yes, one party or the other will win. Okay, that's obvious. That doesn't make it governable. Mm-hmm. Just because one party or the other wins the governorship or wins the legislature does not make California governable, as we have seen. It wasn't governable under Gray Davis when Democrats controlled every lever in the government. In fact, he got recalled. Mm-hmm. They weren't being able to govern either. It's not whether one party or the other party wins, it's a question of whether the structures of government, the mechanisms of government, are such that decisions can be made that deal with the issues that face a very large and dynamic and complicated state. And that's clearly not true.
And on we go to Sacramento. Gary, join us. Hi.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask, as a result of all those countless and ceaseless Meg Whitman ads, am I the only voter that's starting to not see her so much as a candidate anymore, but as a television equivalent of a telemarketer, because she's got something she's after, and she doesn't seem to care how many times or how often she invades my space, and I'm looking forward to the idea of her losing in November so that I can stop seeing her face and hearing her voice on my TV. And I was just wondering if that's if I'm unique or if that's just something that, that comes with it.
No, there is
an anecdote, Michael. I got a call yesterday from Variety,
Barbara O'Connor,
who doesn't normally write on these things, and the premise of the senior editor was, is she overexposed? That's the television take on it. And everybody has DVRs now. I mean, if you look at, this is, again, media patterns and use. If you look at penetration of DVRs or some kind of a machine that allows you to fast forward, that's what people do. They, during the peak of these ads, they record everything and they run through them. So the caller is absolutely correct.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll try to get one more call in about the race between Boxer and Fiorina, and that's you, David. Hi.
Yeah, you know, it struck me listening to the debate yesterday how much we were talking about HP and Carly's record at HP, and you know, it. Senator is a big job. You kind of, it seems like I'd rather see somebody running who has some political experience. You know, if she was running for Congress, then I would be more comfortable for that. But, you know, why can't the Republicans field candidates for governor or for Senate that, that have had an elected position? Those are big jobs.
Well, I thank you for that call. I mean, we've got seconds left here, but Dan Walters, it seemed to me the Republicans felt more comfortable with Fiorina because, unlike Campbell, she was probably more in their ideological camp.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it was. Well, that's probably true, but the other thing is that she had money. And Republicans in this state are the poor party. And it seems strange, but that's
true.
Yeah,
it does seem strange.
And so Republicans like having self-financed candidates or candidates that can at least partially finance themselves, or in the case of Meg Whitman, who can completely finance themselves, because it overcomes the other disadvantage that Republicans have in terms of voter registration. I know people don't like hearing all those ads, but that's how you win elections.
Well, we're at the end of the hour. I want to thank you, Dan Walters from the Sacramento Bee, and Barbara O'Connor from Sacramento State and the Institute for the Study of Politics and Media there. And thank you, our listeners. Let's hope we get a budget. I want to thank also our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell, and our interns, Nadia Reed, Elena Cattavani, and Aiden Stone. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.